Hello, I'm Danny Aiken, president of Southeastern Baptist Theological Seminary. We want to thank you for listening to this chapel message. Our mission at Southeastern is to seek to glorify the Lord Jesus Christ by equipping students to serve the church and fulfill the Great Commission. We hope that you enjoy this chapel message and that you will visit our website. It's www.sebts.edu. There you can learn more about our school and what the Lord is doing here. We hope you enjoy the message. Thank you for being a part of what we're doing here.
Yesterday, for those of you who were here, I argued that since Christ is Lord of all creation, and since the Great Commission is a mandate from that cosmic Lord, since the commission doesn't say, go make converts, it says, I'm Lord of heaven and earth, therefore make disciples, teach them to observe everything I've commanded, that the church's work of discipleship is not limited to nurturing the internal spiritual life of believers, but rather it involves the nurturing of believers to be zealous for good works in every aspect of their lives. And that phrase, zealous for good works, is from Paul's letter to Titus, a struggling pastor in a church in Crete. This is a lecture, not a sermon. If it were a sermon, my text would be Titus 1:12, which possibly has become what we used to call my life verse. One of the Cretans, a prophet of their own, said, Cretans are always liars, evil beasts, lazy gluttons. It's a wonderful life verse. Paul is eager to combat the influence of a decadent culture in Crete and knows that Titus has to equip himself for that. He's concerned about promoting good works, but lest there be any confusion within Titus's congregation, Paul makes it clear that zeal for good works is the effect, not the ground, of salvation. He writes, He saved us not because of works done by us in righteousness, but according to His own mercy, by the washing of regeneration and renewal of the Holy Spirit, whom He poured out on us richly through Jesus Christ our Savior, so that, being justified by His grace, we might become heirs according to the hope of eternal life. Paul packs it in. But he doesn't stop there. As if the main task of pastoral ministry is to advance an orthodox understanding of soteriology. He goes on, I want you to insist on these things, this rich doctrine, so that those who have believed in God may be careful to devote themselves to good works. These things are excellent and profitable for people. That phrase, good works, appears again at the very end of the letter. Let our people learn to devote themselves to good works so as to help cases of urgent need and not be unfruitful. It's interesting. Let our people. Paul speaking with the first person plural. This is not a faith for individualism. This is a faith that brings people into a community. That's what baptism does. Let our people devote themselves to good works. That phrase also appears in chapter 2 when Paul's instructing Titus about his own behavior. Show yourself in all respects to be a model of good works. And it shows up in chapter 1 when Paul condemns the false teachers as unfit for any good work. I wanted to stress this just in case you thought that the letter of James was the only place in the New Testament where good works are so strongly emphasized. You should reread Titus. Luther should have reread Titus. He thought James was an epistle of straw and wasn't sure it should be part of the canon because it stressed good works enough. I'm not sure what he said about Titus. I should go back. Maybe he was as suspicious of this letter. Paul had really good reasons for exhorting Titus to urge his congregation towards zealous faithfulness. The culture in which they lived was morally lazy and vicious, that is, given to vice. It would have been easy in such a setting for the message of grace to have become culturally contextualized as a license for antinomianism. But Paul knew that the message of salvation was about renunciation and purity, as well as about grace and hope. Orthodox belief and believing faith are not ends in themselves, but the first steps toward a way of life that avoids conformity to the world. And these themes of the upright life enabled by the work of Christ were especially important in a place like Crete. Now, as is the case with many of the letters of Paul, this epistle to Titus was written in the context of a destructive and divisive heresy that was harming the church that Titus was ministering in. And as in other settings, the influence of the surrounding culture was intertwined with the false teaching. But this situation differed from that of Colossae or Corinth in that while the false teachers themselves are depicted by Paul very dramatically as being captive to cultural disorder, the false teachings seem surprisingly countercultural. In chapter 1, verse 10, Paul refers to the circumcision group as a particular problem. In verse 14 and 15, he refers to Jewish myths and to what sounds like a legalistic or ascetic tendency in the false teaching. And in chapter 3, he mentions genealogies and arguments about the law. All of this suggests a Judaizing heresy like that of the church in Galatia. But the teachers themselves, while they're advancing this legalistic heresy, hardly seem like an over-scrupulous bunch. In chapter 1, verse 11, one of the oddest verses, verse 12, one of the oddest verses in the entire New Testament, my life verse, Paul cites a 6th century B.C. Cretan poet, Epimenides, to summarize the cultural milieu that explains the mentality of these false teachers. And he refers to Epimenides as a prophet of their own. It's the only time, I think, in the entire Bible where a non-believer, someone outside the covenant community, is referred to as a prophet. He doesn't say it's just a prophet. It's one of their prophets, someone they regard as a prophet. But that's an esteemed label to give to this poet. And he quotes this little proverb, Cretans are always liars, evil beasts, lazy gluttons, and then goes on to say, this testimony is true, just to underline it. Now, it looks like an ethnic slur. What's this doing here? It hardly seems, not only is it not politically correct, it hardly seems a characteristic of description of people who take the law too seriously. And a key to this paradox, I think, is found in the preceding verse where Paul mentions that these teachers are advancing their illicit ideas for the sake of dishonest gain. They're just in it for the money. On reading this charge, any literate contemporary of Paul may well have remembered a comment in Cicero's Republic in which he quips that, quote, the Cretans consider highway robbery honorable. It seems that some rebellious and detestable and warped charlatans, and those adjectives, not the noun, but those adjectives are all Paul's adjectives, had been leading Cretan churchgoers astray with a rigorous and legalistic body of teaching which the teachers themselves didn't believe. They were opportunistic hypocrites. They were fulfilling the proverbial description of Cretans in their indifference to the truth, their preoccupation with serving only their own appetites, and their instinct for predatory behavior. And so Titus is waging a two-front war. On the one hand, there was a deeply rooted, powerfully influential, profoundly problematic ethos of the culture, which was given over to bestial behavior, which fueled the evil mischief of his adversaries. And on the other hand was a countercultural body of false ideas, accepted by, I think we can assume, well-meaning people who were being misled. I think what we have here is a case that where the victims of this religious fraud were properly troubled by the decadent culture around them. And they were looking for a liberating alternative to lazy, gluttonous, bestial behavior. And some Cretan con men, looking for a fast drachma, were ready to serve as their gurus. and in offering a strategy for combating these contrasting forces. On the one hand, a culture of libertinism. On the other hand, a heresy of legalism. Paul provides a paradigm for pastoring that demonstrates how seriously pastors should regard cultural disorder. Since the heresy Titus is facing is one that apparently linked salvation with the keeping of certain aspects of the law, one would think that this letter would be saturated with effusive language about grace and the uselessness of the law in obtaining salvation. But instead, Paul, guided by the Spirit, places more emphasis on the importance of holy living and self-control, a term that shows up 5 times in the letter, while the word grace only appears twice in the body of the letter. It appears more perfunctorily in the salutation and closing. If any contemporary Calvinists were confronted with a Judaizing heresy, it's hard to imagine they'd respond with an admonition that was so heavy on the necessity of obedience. So how might we explain this? Let me suggest that Paul recognized that as destructive as the heresies in the church were, the cultural disorder surrounding the church in Crete was a more severe threat over the long term. How could that be the case? Wouldn't heresy be the most severe threat? I think it's clear that the false teachers were motivated, were energized by the defective vices that were characteristic in that culture. I think that's clear by Paul quoting Epimenides and saying, "This testimony is true, therefore rebuke them sharply that they may be sound in the faith." The false teachers were behaving in a typically Cretan way. But I wonder whether Paul saw that the victims of this heresy, the ones who'd been led astray, were also victims of their own failure to cultivate dispositions that were deliberate and thoughtful and reasonable. Like their opportunistic mentors, they lived in a culture that had never encouraged disciplined and temperate living. And so, in accepting bad theology, they'd simply moved from being mindless lawbreakers to mindless lawkeepers. They'd gone from being wild animals to highly domesticated animals. And before they could benefit from any explanations about the proper relationship between grace and law that we find in those other epistles, the Cretan church needed habits of mind and heart and body that enabled them to stop living so instinctually. They came from a culture that celebrated subhuman behavior. Before they could hold on to the truth, they had to recover their mere humanity. Now look at the list of virtues that Paul enjoins Titus to encourage. Chapter 2, verse 1, "But as for you, teach what accords with sound doctrine." And then look at the list. In the English Standard Version, all of the nouns and adjectives are, here's a list: sober-minded, dignified, self-controlled, steadfast, reverent, not slaves to much wine, pure, working at home, submissive. He talks about integrity and dignity, soundness in speech, not argumentative. This is a life of great control. It's almost a list of Stoic virtues, not the fruit of the Spirit. The New International Version uses other synonyms: temperate, sound in endurance. The Revised Standard Version, adjectives: serious, chaste, domestic, grave, and my favorite, not refractory. That's what we all aim for. No. The New English Bible adds, as one might expect, high principled. Nice Anglican virtue there. The King James translators included the words patience, discreet, obedient, sincere, and uses the word fidelity. Do you feel a pattern forming here? I don't think this is a list of things to encourage that most of us would come up with if we were fighting the tendency to take the law too seriously. But Paul knows that ideas do not live in our brains immune from our passions. Human beings are not simply calculators. Paul knows that the sustaining of good thoughts requires the capacity for thoughtfulness. that the good use of reason requires habits of reasonableness, that disciples need disciplines. Orthodoxy doesn't take root in minds that have never been cultivated. And godly obedience will not be evident where self-control of any kind has never been encouraged. There are, in other words, natural virtues, that is, virtues that are suitable to our nature, that must be in place so that the lives of deliberate faithfulness can be sustained. The salvation procured by Christ for men and women is not available to animals. And I think that Paul saw in Crete, a place concerning which Calvin uses the phrase, as though at the heart of hell, this is not a friendly place to minister. Paul saw a profound cultural disorder that mere argument couldn't undo. And so Titus is not exhorted just to teach sound doctrine. Unfortunately, that's the English Standard Version subheading over chapter 2, teach sound doctrine. And then right after that, it says, teach what accords with sound doctrine. And then he lists not lots of doctrinal things, but things like self-control and steadfastness and dignity. Teach what is in accord with sound doctrine, what befits sound doctrine, what is in keeping with wholesome doctrine, as one translation uses, what becomes sound doctrine, what's becoming if you're orthodox. In other words, teach those virtues and habits that are in harmony with sound doctrine. The lives of believers should exhibit goodness and beauty that corresponds to the truth. Now, how does one teach self-control or reverence or seriousness? It's obviously not enough just to teach about such things. Titus will, as Paul observes, have to, first of all, be an example of such things in his own demeanor, in the way he behaves, in the way he speaks, in his bearing. If he wants these Cretan Christians to be faithful, he won't have the luxury of behaving like a typical Cretan. His way of life, his mannerisms, his deportment, his style of behavior will have to be distinctive. In other words, the form that his life takes has to be in accord with the content of what he's teaching, so that the form the lives of his flock take will likewise be harmoniously appropriate. It's a great lie of modernity that we can neatly separate form from content, either in life or in art, because the thrust of this entire letter argues against that. Now, those things that befit sound doctrine are forms of living. Being reverent or grave or godly is not simply a function of being able to define what it means to be reverent or grave or godly, nor is it a matter simply of asserting one's intention to honor those kinds of definitions. Rather, these virtues require patterns both of inner orientation and of behavior. Some ways of behaving are irreverent. Some are simply unserious. Some are undignified. And these patterns of life are communally sustained within our people, within the community known as our people. So if Titus is to teach such things, then the shared life of his congregation in Crete will have to be, in a distinctive way, a counterculture. Beyond its shared beliefs, it will have to have a set of practices, a body of traditions, a vocabulary, and appropriate institutions capable of sustaining the way of life in which gravity and reverence and self-control and seriousness can be learned, in fact, where it seems natural to practice such things. In other words, they have to have a different culture. I want to talk a little bit about what we mean by culture. What is a culture? Aidan Nichols, Catholic theologian, describes how cultures cultivate us by itemizing four aspects that are evident in every culture. A culture is a system of inherited concepts, that is, it has intellectual dimensions. It's a set of common standards of behavior, that is, it has moral dimensions. A pattern of meaning embodied in symbols, that is, the material culture reflects its convictions. And then a series of conventions governing human interaction. That is, there's an institutional dimension to culture. All of this by which human beings communicate and perpetuate, but also modify and develop their knowledge about and attitudes to life. I want to expand on this list in a minute, but this is a good working framework to think about all the interlocking aspects of culture, what I like to think of as a cultural ecosystem that includes beliefs and practices and material things and institutions. Now, let me suggest that if Titus was to fulfill Paul's expectations, and if pastors today are going to apply this authoritative text in their ministry, Titus would have to do, and you will have to do more, to attend to the way in which cultural ecosystems cultivate the hearts and minds of the members of your church. Teaching things that are in accord with sound doctrine is not simply an intellectual task. Think for a minute how, after all, had all of those negative dispositions been conveyed to the Cretans for centuries? How did they become like they were? Did they read books called Lying for Dummies? Did they go to seminars on how to liberate your inner glutton? Were there workshops on laziness that they worked really hard at? Were there tracts on living more instinctually? I don't think so. There were institutions and practices and artifacts and forms of expression and styles of speech and rituals in the culture that they lived in that conveyed these dispositions or sensibilities to people growing up in that place. That is, there were non-propositional forms, traditions, if you will, that encouraged a particular set of attitudes and habits. Our consciousness and our conscience are not formed simply by listening to arguments. They're shaped by participation in the concrete life of a community with all of its particular ways. And that's what a culture does. That's what a culture is. It's not just a set of commodities that we choose because they're things we like, although that's what contemporary American culture has become. It is really a way of life that conveys a system of meaning. It's important to realize when we think about specific cultural phenomena, specific songs or styles of songs or movies or types of fiction, that these things are not experienced in isolation. They're part of a larger system or environment of experience. Cultures are more like ecosystems than encyclopedias. Cultures are made up of living and dynamic and interactive elements. They're not a collection of static, separable, discrete, inert, abstract components. Cultures are more like organisms than mechanisms. And I've got one word to help you remember this principle: kudzu. Okay? You can't import an alien plant into an ecosystem and expect it to do just one thing. We should have learned that long ago. You can't hope to change just one part of a culture and not have consequences for the whole ecosystem. So, as we think about cultural life, we have to try to take this holistic quality of culture into our minds and learn that we can only understand specific trends as they fit within a larger matrix. You can talk about the meanings or messages of specific songs or movies or books, or you can talk about ideas or attitudes conveyed by specific media, but we also need to be aware of the less obvious but often more profound effects of the whole system within which we receive or experience such things. Let me offer my own description of what I regard as the components or aspects or layers of culture. I haven't come up with a noun yet that describes what these things are, but in order to describe this ecosystem, it seems to me that cultures contain four elements. First, cultures contain what we'll call artifacts, which is a good anthropological term. Books. John Grisham's The Associate. It's his current bestseller. It's a cultural artifact. If you were an anthropologist from Mars coming here 10,000 years from now, digging through the rubble of this civilization, and you came across this book called The Associate, it would be an artifact that you would try to derive certain understanding of who these people were. Anything we perceive with our senses, stuff, movies, music, automobiles, appliances, film, tools, clothing, buildings. virtually any material object that forms the stuff of a way of life for a society at a particular place and time. This is an essential building block of culture. Now, culture also includes organizational institutions. Organizational institutions. The Associates been on the New York Times bestseller list for weeks. Now, getting on the New York Times bestseller list is a way to gain cultural influence through an institutional validation. Getting on Oprah's reading list is another way of gaining a different kind of cultural power. But they're both institutional, organizational institutions that give artifacts a kind of power in culture. Duke University is a cultural university. So is the whole collective we call a cultural institution. So is the collective that we call higher education. Democratic government, professional sports, country music. These are all organizational institutions. Now, thirdly, cultures are made up of what we call practices or conventions, which serve as shared systems of expression. What we call traditions fit this category. Ways of organizing life, ways of ordering life. For some people, reading the Sunday New York Times is a kind of institution, a kind of an institution of practice. The Super Bowl is a practice, almost a liturgical practice for some people. Now, here's where we can see how these things all interact. The Super Bowl is an event. It's ordered and established by organizations, including the NFL, TV networks, Hollywood entertainers, advertisers, marketing firms, and the Homeland Security Agency. But the Super Bowl is an institution is more than any of those organizations do. It has a kind of mythic and ritualistic function in the life of our culture. But it's clearly something that is distinctive to our culture. Conventional practices include holidays, senior proms, shopping, summer vacation rituals, funerals, weddings. Some practices serve practical ends and others are more ritualistic. Now, again, before I go on, I hope you begin to see when we talk about a culture, we're talking about a web or a matrix of interlocking, mutually interdependent things and groups and activities. A novel or a song doesn't exist in isolation from the organizations and the conventions that nurture its creation and that enable it to live, move, and have its being. Now, the fourth layer of culture, when many Christians talk about culture, say things like our culture has a low view of authority or a low view of human life, they usually have this fourth layer in culture, that of beliefs or ideas. But beliefs or ideas don't just hang out there in midair, suspended. Beliefs or ideas are conveyed by artifacts, institutions, and practices in a culture. Conventional practices are the vehicles of belief, and they help to encourage certain beliefs and discourage other beliefs. A culture doesn't believe anything, strictly speaking. Culture doesn't have a brain. But the pattern formed by a culture's interlocking network of artifacts and institutions and organizations and practices will resonate more with some beliefs than with others. They make some beliefs more plausible than others. The relationship between beliefs and other aspects of culture is always symbiotic. Let me give an example. Not long ago, at least within my lifetime, which doesn't seem that long ago, although it may seem like ancient history for some of you, virtually every store in America was closed on Sunday. And that was because of beliefs about the Sabbath. We had certain beliefs, and that dictated certain practices. Now, most of the stores are open. The practices have changed. I'm not sure that's because our beliefs have changed. I'm not sure that there was an ecumenical council or, some sort of agreement between the National Council of Churches and the National Association of Evangelicals and the Chamber of Commerce and decided, well, we no longer believe what we used to about the Sabbath, so it's okay for stores to open. I think stores just started opening, right? They just said, we're not going to be hampered by that anymore, and as long as we don't get much resistance, we'll continue to do it. I don't think the change in belief affected the change in practice. However, the change in practice has probably affected the change in belief. In other words, it's now harder to believe what Christians used to believe about the Sabbath because of the fact that those beliefs are no longer made plausible by the practices of the culture that we live in. Plausibility is a key role that cultural institutions and practices play. They render some beliefs plausible and others implausible. Beliefs never exist in isolation from things, groups, and actions. Ideas do have consequences in the shaping of how we live, but ideas also have antecedents. They come from somewhere and they are sustained by a system of plausibility. And that's what a culture is. A culture is a system of plausibility for ideas. Beliefs shape our practices, but practices also encourage or discourage certain beliefs. Organizations sustain practices, sometimes through the production of artifacts. And that, in turn, convey beliefs to new audiences. Each of these layers influences the other. Each is shaped by the people who inhabit or practice them. But each, in turn, shapes the participants within the culture. We make culture, but we're also shaped by culture. So along the way, in Crete, the beliefs that shaped this indifference to truth and this instinctive behavior formed certain institutions and certain practices, which in turn conveyed a certain attitude toward behavior. And what Paul's saying to Titus is, you've got to break that. You've got to break that cycle if you want your people to be faithful. Now, I want to add two other qualifications before I go on and talk about pastoring that are very significant in culture. They're working at a different layer. We've got things, we've got groups, we've got activities, we've got beliefs, at least four different layers. And taken all together, the elements of a culture convey what we might call a mood or a sensibility or an ethos. The spirit of a culture, its style, which is greater than the sum of its parts. New York brusqueness, English reticence, Texan confidence, Yankee ingenuity, Russian melancholy, Parisian rudeness. Okay? These are stereotypes. You're not supposed to believe in stereotypes. Well, guess what? They're pretty accurate descriptions. They're predictors. Okay? Which is why Russian literature feels different from literature written in England, which feels different from literature written in America, at least insofar as those cultures are still vibrant and still active. These cultural sensibilities are conveyed and sustained through practices and institutions and artifacts. And they're linked up with dominant beliefs in a culture. They're not beliefs themselves. That is the kind of melancholy mood you might find in Russia. It doesn't constitute a belief. But certain beliefs are likely to seem more plausible in Russia than they would in Las Vegas. Okay? Now, not every person living in a culture shares its dominant sensibilities. Titus surely must have had some men he could appoint as elders in Crete, but those dominant sensibilities nonetheless exert to a greater or lesser degrees a kind of pressure, a kind of gravitational pull on everyone living in the culture. For instance, if you live in a culture that conveys a sensibility of rugged individualism, then certain beliefs about the good of community and common life may be less plausible and harder to hold on to. If the institutions of your culture rewards of utilitarian practicality, then the idea of mystery or the function of imagination might seem alien and a little strange to you. Not entirely unavailable, but again, implausible. So a culture also conveys a kind of sensibility. And that, I think, is evident in the fact that Titus is being exhorted to encourage different sensibilities, sensibilities which are not typical in Crete. Second qualification that I want to add is how we think about ideas in a culture or beliefs. Every individual and many organizations have explicit beliefs that they can articulate in almost a creedal fashion. I believe such and such. Our Declaration of Independence asserts certain self-evident truths that influence more or less the kind of things we allow government to do. By collectively giving a prominent place in our national consciousness to specific things like liberty, for example, even non-governmental institutions tend to allow concerns for liberty to be very dominant. But in addition to the role that explicit beliefs play, individuals and groups are also guided by tacit or implicit beliefs, something they know in their gut, not necessarily something they might assert or put in a bullet point of a creed. I sometimes use the term deep assumptions about reality to label these kinds of convictions. Richard Weaver, in his book Ideas Have Consequences, referred to them as our metaphysical dream of the world, our intuitive sense of the kinds of creatures we are, the kind of world we live in, and the kind of purposes we would do well to pursue. The term meta-belief sounds a little technical, a little highfalutin, but it might be helpful. This bedrock layer of assumptions or intuitions or prejudices, maybe we could call them, it's not so much a body of ideas as a posture or an orientation. For instance, some people have the sense that they are finite creatures dependent on and loved by God. They have it. They know it in their gut. They know it at the deepest part of their being. Others intuitively have a sense that they are just meaningless meat in a chaotic cosmos. These aren't strictly beliefs. That is, they're not something that people might articulate specifically. But they're deeper than beliefs. Sometimes they aren't even explicitly known, and sometimes they might be sincerely denied if someone holding them was to be questioned. And I think, in fact, many Christians suffer because what they're trying to believe, what the Bible tells them they should believe, what their pastors are preaching about, what they've been taught they ought to believe, has not sunk into their deepest consciousness. They might affirm a belief in divine goodness or sovereignty, but at the deepest level of their being, perhaps in what the Bible calls their hearts, these affirmations do not dwell in them richly. They can accept the arguments for God's goodness, but their moral imagination hasn't embraced it, in large measure because the culture around them doesn't seem to make it plausible. Now, I've described this condition as it applies principally to individuals, but my main point is here that cultures can encourage certain meta-beliefs, certain assumptions about reality, certain, let's call them presuppositions, more than others. Cultural experience can make it more or less likely to have a deep conviction that we are made for community and that all of creation is the work of a God in whom dynamic love is a perpetual reality. Patterns of cultural life can make the idea that material existence is a blessing and not a curse more or less plausible. A culture could make the idea that God is a righteous and rightful judge more easy to embrace because of the patterns of life it encourages and the artifacts that are encountered there. Now, this shaping of this deep understanding, consciousness, is what a culture does. And one of the reasons I argue that the church has to be countercultural is because we're not just adding a few, we're not augmenting a couple of specific religious beliefs to a cosmology, to a set of assumptions about reality in American life that's essentially sound. We're really reshaping the deepest intuitions of people. And that is a task of cultivation that the shape of the life the church takes has to try to nurture. James Davison Hunter has written a wonderful book. He's a sociologist at UVA, a book called The Death of Character. And he explores ways in which character and a conviction of morality and a sense of conscience is shaped by social experience, shaped by the habits and practices of communities. He writes, most of what constitutes morality refers to basic attitudes toward life and an underlying and implicit vision of reality. These not only provide a foundation for a moral life, but they frame the horizon of our moral imagination. That is what we can imagine we ought to do. And how is that conveyed to us? He says it's ritualized in habit, it's routinized in institutions, these codes of prohibition and permission, and more fundamentally, these attitudes, ideals, sensibilities, and dispositions, these tendencies of the heart, provide the terms by which individual life is made predictable. Moral meaning comes not just from a list of do's and don'ts, but from the deepest shaping of the conscience through ideals and sensibilities and dispositions. And this is why Paul is so eager to get these people to acquire these different dispositions, reverence and gravity, self-control. So applying this sociological observation to Paul's letter, we could say that these proverbially bad character attributes, the bad moral framework and practices of Crete, had been sustained by habits and institutions and implicit codes that permeated Cretan culture. And the church, in training its members in a different way of life, similarly needed a set of practices and institutions to implant an inner compass to inform the affections of its members. The church needed its own culture, not just a list of timeless truths. So Titus had to give attention to the ways in which the forms of Cretan cultural life had encouraged its destructive vices and exhort his flock to abstain from those forms. The church in Crete had to forge a way of life that encouraged the virtues that countered Cretan vices. And that encouragement had to be at a deep level, at a level of assumption and intuition. In other words, the church's task was to encourage virtues, not just insights for living, rationally received. In his book, After Virtue, moral philosopher Alasdair MacIntyre comments that virtues are dispositions not only to act in particular ways, but also to feel in particular ways. To act virtuously is not to act against inclination. It is to act from inclination formed by the cultivation of the virtues. So the task of pastoring, the task of discipleship, is to shape proper inclinations. Inclinations to love what is true and good, not simply to endorse it with a check mark on a list. So as Titus and his elders set about to do this, they had to be discerning about their tactics. They couldn't just borrow cultural forms from Cretan culture that had been evolving for centuries precisely because they had a capacity to encourage laziness and expect them to be retasked in the interest of encouraging industriousness. I'm reminded of a story I heard Eugene Peterson tell several years ago about how he encouraged his congregation to avoid the tyranny of addiction to speed and dehumanizing efficiency, which is characteristic in our culture. We were at a consultation on technology in the church, and we'd been talking about the temptation to emulate our machines, to be on a perpetual upgrade path, to live without patience, without openness to wonder, without attentiveness. And Peterson commented that he thought one of the most important lessons he'd ever tried to teach his own congregation was to take time to worship. So much of our lives is relentlessly governed by the clock, by the demands of efficiency. But surely we shouldn't try to worship God efficiently. Surely we shouldn't try to love our spouses or children efficiently. I don't even treat my dog governed solely by efficiency. So Peterson decided to teach the inadequacy of efficiency as a rule for governing everything, but he wouldn't just give a lecture on this or a sermon on this. He decided to slow down his worship service. So when it was time for him to offer a pastoral prayer, instead of jogging up to the pulpit as if he was in a hurry to get it over with, I don't know, lest the Holy Spirit arrive and interrupt the flow, he sat in his chair for several seconds. And then he calmly walked to the pulpit. And he paused and he said, "Let us pray." And instead of jumping right into the prayer, he allowed some time for his congregation to collect themselves, to eliminate the distractions that they were beset by, to be focused on what they were doing in prayer. and to be present to God. And sometimes 10 seconds or 20 seconds would elapse before he'd begin to pray. He said, the first time I did it, some people thought I'd had a heart attack. But I thought it was important to teach them to take time to worship. And as he was telling the story, he paused and then he remarked to us, it took about 10 years to get the point across. I was blown away by this. It's a great example of a countercultural convention that reorients experience in space and time in order to reorient the affections, which in turn would have consequences in how people live day in and day out. Peterson's strategy wasn't just designed to teach an insight about worship or about time. He intended that his way of ordering worship would bring them to an internal recognition of something deficient and disordered in their everyday lives. By making the worship service seem less like a television program, he was able, over the course of time, to reorient his congregation's experience so that they were, among many other things, more likely to perceive the disordering effects of that frenetic, restless, clock-driven life that is sustained by television and other institutions. Acquiring not just the ability, but the taste to take time to worship isn't learning a doctrine as such, but it is a capacity that is in accord with sound doctrine. And having learned how to be attentive to this moment rather than rushing on to the next, his congregation was equipped to learn many other things, doctrinal and practical. And it only took 10 years. That's the thing that impressed me most, is that he persevered. I've shared this story with many pastors, a number of whom have appreciated the wisdom, but one pastor said to me, that's a great idea, but my session wouldn't let, they'd fire me if I tried that. Well, it's interesting, on another occasion in another conversation, this same pastor complained to me that his session treated him like their pool boy. They know what they want, and they're just going to get it. That's even less prestige than being a cruise director, as I suggested yesterday, many, many pastors become. Now, I think Peterson's congregation gave him time to do this, didn't fire him right away, because although, even though what he was doing seemed strange, they knew that he loved them and cared for them. They respected him as a shepherd. And I know this because of other things he's written and said about how he took time with his people, how he entered into their lives. It never would have occurred to Peterson to accommodate his congregation's temperamental preferences by producing an animated PowerPoint presentation, if they'd even had PowerPoint then, or a quick-cutting video, in order to convey a different orientation toward the relationship of time and the sacred. That would have been self-defeating. He knew that training in faithfulness required methods that are fitting for what is being conveyed, just as our lives are to be fitting for what it is that we believe. What we believe about God, about human nature, about the good ordering of human life and the realities of creation. Now, in working to understand better how beliefs and dispositions and cultural forms all interact, I think that pastors would do well to acquaint themselves with some of the more perceptive secular critics of contemporary culture. Paul himself relied on a pagan poet who had pithily characterized the cultural disorder in Crete. Now, some Christians are nervous about relying on secular critics for wisdom in how they do ministry. Calvin, in commenting on Paul's citation from Epimenides, says that such scruples are wrong-headed. Quote, from this passage we may gather that it is superstitious to refuse to make any use of secular authors. For since all truth is of God, if any ungodly man has said anything true, we should not reject it, for it also has come from God. Besides, since all things are from God, what could be wrong with employing to his glory everything that can be rightly used in that way? In his commentary on Titus, when explaining Paul's commending of the virtue of temperance, for instance, Calvin himself quotes from Plato. Quote, his only injunction about the young men is that they should be instructed to be temperate, for temperance, as Plato teaches, sets right the whole mind of man, It is as if he had said, let them be well regulated and obedient to reason, close quote. Paul references Plato, thereby acknowledging in Paul, Calvin references Plato, thereby acknowledging in Paul's strategic pastoral wisdom an echo of classical teaching about the importance of the virtues. So Paul is appropriating useful wisdom from a pagan writer in the cause of a radical criticism of the culture in which the pagan author lived. So Paul provides a model for discerning cultural engagement. All truth is God's truth, but not all truth claims are true. All good cultural resources, from whatever source, can be employed in the service of God and his kingdom, but not all cultural resources are good. Secular critics can bring a great advantage to understanding culture, since they have no eschatological hope. Since this world and its arrangements of human life are all that there is, they sometimes can be more alert and incisive than Christian thinkers. Sometimes more attentive to things that have gone awry. Christians who radically separate life in this world from life in the new heavens and the new earth might be tempted to a certain negligence as they make their pilgrimage through the ruins of modernity. But thoughtful secular humanists who really care about the state of human life in this world can oddly be ministers of common grace despite themselves. Often the disgruntled critics of contemporary culture are the truest seekers. Their perception of cultural disorder leads them to long for order. But all too often, American churches have emulated the most popular trends of our cultural moment, not because they're good, but because they're popular, in order to attract people who want a spiritual supplement to a cultural status quo, not a radical critique of the cultural status quo. Evangelicals have long been tempted to identify with the cultural majority in the interest of reaching more people with the gospel, and so we tend to look kindly toward leaders of institutions that represent the cultural majority. We tend to be more likely to emulate the practices of successful cultural enterprises in business or entertainment or sports or education, rather than to examine those practices critically to ascertain how they might contribute to cultural disorder. Finally, I think Christians are afraid of being too critical of conventional trends out of fear of being legalistic. It seems better to give cultural forms the benefit of the doubt than to make strong judgments. Well, there are several problems with that sort of attitude. First, we need to realize that the making of judgments can take the form of endorsement as well as condemnation. Endorsing a cultural trend is no less a judgment than criticizing it. When we challenge something that's popular and thus perceived to be non-problematic, that is somehow perceived as setting ourselves up as a judge. But when we conclude that some popular trend or movement is valuable, it's assumed that no judgment was involved. And if there was ever a place to worry about legalism, it was the church in Crete. But Paul didn't seem to be worried. Paul, the masterful theologian of grace, is not afraid to critique Cretan culture and to establish a well-developed set of countercultural patterns of behavior. My time is up. To skip a few pages. Church historian Robert Wilkin has recently observed that at this moment in the church's history, in this country and in the West more generally, it is less urgent to convince the alternative culture in which we live of the truth of Christ than it is for the church to tell itself its own story and to nurture its own life, the culture of the city of God. As our culture becomes more and more post-Christian, more and more worldly, it's imperative that believers define the church on God's terms, not the world's. We need to be more deliberate about obeying Paul's call to have our minds transformed so that all of our perceptions are in keeping with God's word and will. Paul states that in Romans 12 in the form of a command. He suggests it won't happen without effort. Our minds need to be continually renewed, transformed away from the world's deep assumptions about reality, assumptions which are contrary to what God has done and what God has said. And that transformation requires more than good teaching. It requires the church and its leaders to train our hearts through practices and sensibilities that are in accord with sound doctrine so that our lives can be, as Paul says, an adornment to the truth. Thank you very much.
Thank you again for listening to this chapel message from Southeastern Baptist Theological Seminary. If you are thinking about theological education on the undergraduate or graduate level, including doctoral studies, we hope that you consider us. If you also find these chapel messages encouraging and a blessing to your walk with Christ, we hope that you will consider financially supporting Southeastern. Our graduates are literally serving the kingdom across this globe, working to carry the gospel of Jesus Christ to a lost and dying world. Your gifts will help to train more, and they will serve as a worthwhile investment in God's kingdom. You can find more information about attending Southeastern or supporting us financially at www.sebts.edu. We covet your prayers and trust that God will bless every good work you do for His glory. Thank you for joining us in our chapel services.